sorry.
Okay. No, not a problem. So, Mr. Cassano, before we took a break, could you, you were talking about the robust underwriting discipline, that you maintained a robust underwriting discipline. Can you explain that underwriting discipline at AIGFP for the multi-sector book?
Yes. So the underwriting that we would go through is first would be a fundamental review of the credit quality of the proposed deals, which would entail the financial products credit officers reviewing the proposed portfolios and reviewing the proposed portfolios for credit attributes within those, within the proposed portfolio, making sure that they believed that on a fundamental basis that these were all good credits within the transactions. Then after their review and sign off on the on that part of the transaction, they the transaction would be run through the Gary Gorton, Professor Gorton's model, to make sure that we were hitting the targets, that it was meeting the standards that we had working with, which includes the 99.85 confidence level. Also, that there would be a substantial piece of the transaction would be rated AAA by at least one of the credit rating agencies. Once that review was done and everybody concurred on that, that's when the transaction approval memo would be written and then sent to the parent company for them to evaluate the underlying transaction and making sure that they, you know, for them to concur or approve with the analysis that was performed at FP.
Or require different deal terms or like.
Right. I mean, they could come back and tell us to change certain things or do something different or not do the deal.
Now, Chris, that's the approval at the front end. You know that there was a monitoring, you know, regular monitoring of the transaction after. They weren't fire and forget deals. So I just want to make sure, because that's why I said the writing part was complex. Okay.
Right. So let's talk a little bit about the first part of that, the credit quality guys looking at the proposed portfolio. I know when we've looked at the transaction approval memos, there's always like a listing in the back. I think it's called an annex.
That right, collateral annex.
The collateral that's part of the deal. What kind of analysis was done of that collateral, if you know, if you recall?
Yeah, I don't remember.
Okay. We noticed in a lot of deals that the fact that this is called the multi-sector book, to a certain extent, looks like somewhat of a misnomer. It looks like most of the collateral in these deals was real estate related. Is that your recollection?
He's not asking if you agree with the misnomer characterization.
Right, right.
He's asking whether
right. I was just thinking
that it was mostly RMBS.
The portfolios substantially were RMBS, but and then there were a few that were also substantially CMBS.
Do you know if the credit quality folk, when they're looking at the portfolio, were actually looking at the types of loans that, as we see designated in the annex, as prime or RMBSA? And what I'm getting at.
RMBSA.
Well, that's just how we see it designated in the annex and in the memo. So that's FP's term, not ours. But I think the A just means prime. But for example, we've sampled a few of the deals and we see fair amount of interest only, fair amount of all day, fair amount of no doc underwriting loans included within the prime category of the RMBS. Were you aware of that while you were at FB?
Not to my recollection.
Okay. We've also, another designation in the annex is home equity type loans. And in there, we've seen a fair amount of subprime, where the home equity collateral contained subprime.
Yeah, I was aware that some of these deals had some subprime in them, yes.
Okay, but that, I understand that, because there's actually other designations within the annex for subprime, but there's a separate designation for home equity. It's just called HEL in the annexes. They just shorten it up that way. And my question is do you recall whether or not you knew for that non-subprime designation of home equity that nevertheless it included subprime? Was that unclear?
I'm asking if you recall.
I don't remember. I mean, as right.
Generally, you recall they're subprime.
Yes.
But to my specific question, you don't recall.
No.
Okay.
There's also categories that are called mid-prime, RMBS. And when we sampled some of the mid-prime RMBS CUSIPs, the underlying collateral was subprime. Were you aware of that?
No.
Were there any just overall limits on the size that the multi-sector book could be? And I know you guys stopped writing at the end of 05, subject to the pipeline, but were there limits on the size of the book?
Not that I know of.
Okay.
Each deal needed to be approved.
Right.
So it was sort of the singular portfolio approval process, right? So each deal was its own portfolio. But I don't know of any absolute limit that was set.
I don't remember
that there was an absolute limit set.
Sure. And there was. And I'm just trying to see if I can jog memory bells. Okay. And I don't know this, but there's no limits. For example, the book, whether any type of book, can only be X percent of capital.
No, I thought I remember.
Okay. And in the up until the decision to stop writing CDS on subprime multi-sector CDOs, who is in charge of bringing the deals and getting the deals closed?
In the deals we're talking about in the multi-sector CDS, right?
Thank you.
Okay. And principally Al Frost in our Connecticut office.
Okay. Okay. And what is Mr. Forster's role?
Mr. Forster was the global head of credit trading.
Okay. Which meant Mr. Frost reported to him?
In doing all of the multi-sector CDOs that were done needed to be reviewed by Andrew prior to them being executed.
Okay.
Reviewed and approved. Andy had to say okay.
Mm-hmm. So Mr. Forster, Andy would have to say okay, and then the transactional approval memo gets done. Is that how it worked, just in terms of flow? Or would he get the transactional memo?
I'm not sure. Yeah. I'm just hesitating. I think you need to ask Andrew Officer how that worked. And I just want to clarify this a bit. So Al Frost was within the organization designated as a marketer transactor.
Right.
Andrew Foster was the head trader. And so he was the one who was making the ultimate decision. So Alan would prospect, find the deal, structure the deal, right, work with the credit people and everybody. But he also was closely coordinating with Andrew and his team, whoever Andrew would have designated, on whether or not they wanted to have this transaction in our portfolio. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Thank you. How did the company determine the price they were going to charge the multi-sector book?
Can I just ask you one question?
Sure.
At a time when you're done with the underwriting standards, I don't want to interrupt your flow. At the time that you're done with the underwriting standards, I just have one comment and a question to ask. So just let me know when you're making a transition into something else.
Okay. Well, hit me right now.
Okay. Your focus on this is, I didn't realize that you were going to focus this much on it, in light of the fact that at least it's our understanding that if the government held the CDS portfolio today and they weren't unwound, none of the CDOs would have tripped the super senior triggers, and there would have been no contractual payouts. And so when Joe said what's in, you have to look in what's in maiden lane three. I just hope that we weren't on the same page, and I'm hoping that you will confirm to me that that's your understanding, because the strength of the underwriting standards that Joe was referring to is in that. If the defaults have not pierced the super senior level yet, then even in spite of this huge financial crisis, those assets, if the government had held them and decided, and instead of paying out 100 cents on the dollar and unwinding the contracts, had held the CDS portfolios, they wouldn't have had any contractual payouts, because the default rate would have never pierced the super senior layer, at least to our knowledge. Do you know that that's true?
I don't know that that's true.
That seems to me to be a really important question in judging the underwriting standards.
Yeah, I was going to say, do you know underwriting standards?
Right.
Even if you find issues or problems with, like, the issue that you raised, if at the end of the day those CDOs have not had defaults that would have pierced the super senior level, that kind of goes fundamentally towards whether or not the government should have unwound the contracts and spent the additional $40 billion of the taxpayers' money unwinding the CDSs as opposed to holding the derivatives.
And that actually raises a question that I have. So my understanding is that the terms of these contracts, instead of my understanding, what is your understanding of what the terms of these contracts are in terms of length?
Length, maturity.
Yes.
I always think of them in terms of average life. I don't
find
right. So, my understanding is at the end of 07, I think the average life was probably around the 4.5 to 5 year mark.
Okay. So, what happens once the contract expires and there's collateral that's been posted? What happens at the end of the contract?
You get the collateral back.
And that fundamentally is, that's why I asked that question about our terms, because people have talked about losses and then referred to the money that was supposed to...
Sorry, what Jim's saying, the collateral call was not a loss.
I understand for accounting. Well,
no, it wasn't for accounting, economically. It was carried on the books as an asset.
I understand.
Okay.
I understand that.
Right. Oh, sorry. I thought that's what you're asking.
Okay.
That's simply a liquidity risk.
Yeah,
that's
exactly
ascribed
right.
to the transaction. Exactly right. You have market risk, you have credit risk, and you have liquidity risk.
Right. Absolutely right. And, I mean, I don't want to dominate this. I mean, we want you to have access to Joe. But what we thought you were going to ask about, really, when we talked about this, was once the government kind of came in and occupied AIG's shoes and was then AAA, right, the collateral call should have gone down dramatically, right, because it was only based on AIG's the downgrade in their credit that the collateral calls increased. And so the question we thought you were going to ask, and maybe you will ask, you'll get to it, is, what's your view on that? Once the government came in and essentially backed the transactions with its own rating, why didn't the collateral calls decrease, and why wasn't there more leverage to resist the collateral calls as opposed to less leverage?
But the public filings also state that the collateral calls are triggered by a decline in the underlying value of the cash CDO, correct?
Absolutely, but so here's the rub.
That even if the government has the ownership, that underlying collateral, if it's filled with subprime, mid-prime all day, and that continues to deteriorate in performance, the value of that is going to continue to go down.
Correct. But here's the rub. If the credit rating is at AAA, right, they can make a far smaller collateral call. Right? And so the reason that the collateral calls increased, right, they never got to 100%. No one was ever asking for 100% on the dollar. Right, and so by paying out 100 cents, they essentially accelerated and took the assets, right, which they never would have had to do even under those circumstances. But with the government's backing the AAA credit rating, the collateral call should have decreased in size, not increased in size. And that's the part that I mean, let's play it out.
Let's have Mr. Cassano play it out. We can bring you on to the 30th too if you want.
Yeah. I apologize.
But since we're here, Mr. Cassano, let's get your views on it. What are your views on the Maiden Lane 3 transaction?
In what respect, Chris?
In the respect we're talking about.
Which is?
In terms of the ultimate losses and the collateral calls.
Okay. I'm surprised that the government paid out 100 cents on the dollar to the counterparts on these transactions. I don't understand why they did that. One thing is this somewhat, I look at Maiden Lane 3 and I see that Maiden Lane 3 is performing, right? The assets seem to all be performing in there, right? We know that the government had lent it $24 billion. We now know the balance of the government loan is about $16 billion. So I know that $8 billion has been paid off from the amortization of the underlying assets in Maiden Lane 3. You know, we keep asking this question, does anyone know if what we're saying is false, right? The question we're asking you, we just, you know, it's a little hard, right? All you can do is look at the reports and you're not getting a robust, detailed picture of what's going on. But I think from what we're seeing, there isn't. So that performance is indicating to me that the transactions are all operating as we expected. And think about it, through this financial crisis that necessitated the need and the work of this commission, that even through this, you know, this is the second worst financial crisis that the country's gone through, and they're still performing. So they met that pressurized situation, and they're working. So now go back to the question of what was the analysis that was done that said, let's pay 100 cents on the dollar to all the counterparts, and let's express, or as Jim's word was, advance the funds to the counterpart, and rather than save that, let's say at the time that the company was taken over, is it about $35 billion of collateral had been pledged in
Correct.
September, and you know, and my numbers, obviously I wasn't around for all this, so I'm just reading this stuff in the press, but so $40 billion was advanced. Why not save that for the time if one of the portfolios pierced the attachment levels, right? Because, you know, just a small point is there is subprime in all of these portfolios, but they're not 100% subprime, right? They're, you know, if you look at at least the stats I remember from the presentations we did in the mezzanine segment, the $18 billion that was underlying mezzanine collateral, it was sort of 65% or so. In the high-grade collateral, I think the numbers were somewhere in the, which was the much larger part of the book, the $40 billion or so of the book was, I think, 45% maybe or something like that. So it's not, you know, and I know this term of subprime is also not a hard, there's no, right, this FICO score thing. It's somewhat in the eyes of the beholder, I guess, right? But so I look at that and I wonder, why did we express the money and why not just wait? And maybe the worst case, you would only save the time value, right, of that money. But that's not a bad thing. But what was the urge? And even though now, you know, all the things that have been done and the way the economy is growing, these things are working. So I look at it, and I guess, you know, from the day I just didn't understand. And I thought, well, somebody has a better plan than I did. That must be why they did it, right? Because you know, maybe you don't, during the time that I was in the company, right, I negotiated very hard on all the collateral calls with the counterparts. I held them to what were, the way I think about this is sort of the contractual provisions, contractual defenses that were in the contracts, and made them negotiate with me because I didn't believe the numbers, right? You know, a lot of people were coming in with numbers in this market that, you know, the business side of this market for me said, you know, these aren't real numbers. Nobody's trading this stuff. This market's seized up. Where are these guys getting, where are people getting the numbers? And people who were coming to us with substantial calls, I was vigorous and diligent, as I think I needed to be for the company and for the shareholder, in defending just forking over cash. And we, you know, we had a lot of cash. All during the time that I was with the company, we were able to meet all of these collateral calls. But, and so it's something I, the problem from my vision viewpoint is I'm not there at the end. I can't see what was happening and what compelled these decisions. But if I only take my tunnel vision from March and look forward, or my telescope and look forward in March, I don't get it. Yeah, so I think that's my surprise on this point.
So help me understand one part of it, and I'm probably just going to demonstrate my ignorance here. But I've seen the same numbers, you know, that you're talking about on Main Lane 3 in terms of the balances and the supposed market value of the underlying collateral. But that's after the $35 bill of collateral got posted. So isn't the way to look at it versus the $62.5 billion face value of the securities that were purchased? Help me understand what I'm my analysis is wrong.
Tell me, just review what you said. With
sure. When we look at Maiden Lane 3, and when you look at least the SIG TARP report and stuff on the New York Fed's website,
oh, right,
cetera,
right.
So, you know, what they say is pre-Maiden Lane 3, $35 billion was posted to the counterparties, and then Maiden Lane 3 is $27 billion. So it's $62 billion, right?
Okay.
So, and they get the securities, right? They close out the positions, and the Maiden Lane 3 SPV now owns the securities, right? So when I see, and granted now stuff has been, some of it's been resolved, but at the time, you know, presumably they were saying the market value of those securities was about $29-30 billion, right?
The right. So let's use 50 cents on the dollar.
Right.
At the time.
So help me understand why I'm not seeing a 50% loss on the date Maiden Lane 3 is done because of the $35 bill that had already been posted. You follow me?
God, no, I don't.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
I see $62 billion face value of of securities.
Right.
And they're only worth 30.
Right.
Right. So AIG and the government have shelled out $62 billion for $30 billion of securities.
Why did they do that?
And doesn't that indicate that those securities had a 50% loss?
Who put that price on that, Chris? Who decided they were 50 cents on the dollar?
But can I think that you guys are talking cross purposes a little bit in the sense that he's looking at it from the perspective of what the government would have held if it had not unwound the CDS contracts, right? Right now, the government's holding the CDOs.
Right.
The government didn't have to hold the CDOs. The government could have held the CDS contracts. If the government held the CDS contracts, they would have been getting premiums during the time. There would have been collateral that may have been posted.
Right.
They would have been getting collateral over time, holding those CDS contracts, and the bonds would be amortizing. Mm-hmm. At least as we can see the performance of the portfolio, whatever defaults there have been would not have tripped the super senior triggers, mm-hmm. right? So the point is, okay. The credit quality would have allowed the government to continue to collect premiums, resist the collateral calls, allow those things to go to maturity, and not have spent $40 billion.
And is your point, or let me tell you, so is it the point that if you wouldn't have done that and you would have kept the CDS and not done the Maiden Lane 3 transaction, once either the contract's terminated or whatever, it's given what you're saying about the actual performance, there's no loss on that $62 billion because the collateral comes back when the contracts terminate and perhaps the performance comes back as the economy recovers.
Well, there's a threshold question, which is what are you basing the statement on that there's been no piercing of the super senior tranche?
Dixie?
Yes.
Okay. That's the question we're asking. I'm not.
Well, we're basing. She's asking what I'm basing it on. This is what the government said to us in one of our last sessions, right? The government, the DOJ and the SEC said that they believed that that was a true statement. Right, and our analysis was based on at least what the company has been able to glean. That was what made us believe.
Okay,
that was
so not true. Some document that we haven't seen, obviously.
Well, somebody's got a document,
yeah, but
right?
It's not the folks at BlackRock or the folks, you know.
We're not talking to anybody.
Right. No.
That's why I'm always prefacing this with
saying
I'm not sure. Do you know? Every time I run into someone, I meet someone of authority who might know. I've asked. Whether do you know how this is performing? I haven't met the people at BlackRock, and I don't know if they would tell me anyway. But we don't. So your point is right. There is a bit of conjecture here. But even but
just because the loan's paying off doesn't mean that the super senior hasn't been.
But could you hypothetically conclude from the loan being paid off as rapidly and as large as that amount is that there is a large pool of performing assets in that? A very large pool, so that
point taken. Sure.
Okay, and I think that's the point I'm making is that there may be, and you know, I just know if I'm making this argument right now that we walk out of the room and somebody walks in and says, "Oh, by the way, hey Chris, did you know that in Maiden Lane 3, this one has pierced?" Right, just out of coincidence, that would happen, right? But what we see from this observation point is that we're seeing a substantive repayment of the loan, and you know, you got to think about the $8 billion as being substantive. We're seeing a growth in the value of the equity because we're seeing AIG mark up its ownership in the equity position, I think, you know, by some amount. We're also seeing the mark-to-market value in that H4B thing, right? Whatever that is, that mark-to-market value isn't really going much below the 24, 25 that we saw originally. So that's interesting because the loans have amortized by $8 billion. So you think the securities, we clearly know the securities have paid down $8 billion. And there's a large payment that's going to the federal government. Right, I forgot, what is the number? Is it LIBOR plus, maybe you know it, Stacey? It's some big number. Yeah. LIBOR plus 350 or 450.
Yeah.
Right, it's a little... It's big, right? It's a somewhat egregious rate. And so somebody, right, and that money is going out. And I think if you maybe added that, there'd be another $2 billion life to date so far on what we're seeing on the balances. So I'm just making the point that I'm looking at all of that. And I think where this started was, Chris looked and asked me the question, so Mr. Cassano, what do you think about what went on at this point in time? And I'm saying, from everything I see, I think that the taxpayer would be better off if, in the resolution of AIG's issues, they had ring-fenced somehow the CDSs themselves, stood as the CDS counterpart, worked under the same contracts that I was working under, where I was able to assert, is that the right word?
Yes.
Assert the defenses that, you know, the contractual provisions. And I think we would be better off on a monetary basis, right? Loans and, you know, cash from the Treasury and all those things. And the counterparts would be okay, too, because they'd be sitting there with Uncle Sam really owning this company and supporting it, and with the amount of money that's here that the company that Uncle Sam that the U.S. has put to this company, no one's going to think that they're not going to support this vehicle. And if, you know, there's a whole other argument somewhere else where I can show you where people do believe in the support because all the capital relief trades are still on, right? None of the $400 billion of capital relief business that was on has been, you know, some of it's amortized and unwound and stuff, but a lot of that is still on, and banks are taking relief from that, right? So they believe in the credit quality of the company. Sorry, I'm carrying on. But
I think you answered the question.
Are you okay?
So can I just close this loop in the sense of, and I'm really sorry, I hope this was helpful. I didn't mean to take us down a road that wasn't helpful, and I hope it was. But you guys were focusing so much on risk analysis, you know. Imagine yourself, you're being the person that's got to decide, okay, I've got these CDS contracts. Do I fight the collateral calls and hold these and expose the American taxpayers only to the super senior portion of these CDOs, which from a modeling perspective may never happen? Or do I expose the American taxpayer to the risk of the entire CDO, right, with no protection at all? They made a decision to expose the taxpayer to the entire thing at the cost of $40 billion instead of just saying, we're not paying any more collateral calls because we don't have to. The $35 billion satisfies what you're entitled to given the fact that we're now AAA. Stand down and then wait to see if there was any piercing of the super senior layer before they paid out any money. In terms of risk analysis, that's the risk analysis.
The substantiation of the underwriting that we did, right? You're asking me questions about the rigors of the underwriting, and you're asking me questions about the robustness of the underwriting, and you're asking me questions about the makeup of the portfolios and those things. And I'm looking and I'm saying forget about the collateral calls for a second, right? And I'm saying the fundamental analysis that my team did, the fundamental hard work that AIFP did in conjunction with the people of AIG, these transactions are standing the test of time on that fundamental analysis, even as we drive through or go through this very, very difficult economic period.
If there had, let's say that the company hypothetically could have withstood the liquidity crunch, et cetera, that happened on the multi-sector CDS book, and let's also say hypothetically that there would have been some losses, economic losses, on the portfolio, maybe not crazy big losses, but some losses. What level of losses on that book could FP have withstood?
Well, you know, we clearly withstood $11 billion of losses, right, as of the, I think is it the end of the first quarter, right?
End of fourth quarter, 07.
We announced in the first quarter, right. At the end of the fourth quarter, right, at the end of the first quarter, there were subsequent losses, and the company withstood that. So, you know, I think they could, the company, FPAIG, the whole company, could have withstood meaningful amount of mark-to-market losses, and I think they had until the liquidity crunch came. And then I think it's the combination of losses, inability to access the market, and the liquidity crunch. Uh-huh. And the liquidity crunch coming from a variety of factors. I know FP was a factor in that, but also the securities lending business became a factor. There were other aspects of the AIG business, because the other thing, you know, and this is me again looking through a telescope from far away, but, you know, $180 billion of bailout, but, you know, this $40 billion of it went to the FP book that we're talking about. Where's the rest of it? Right? And, you know, and I'm not, you know, I know some of it's liquidity provisions to be tapped into and stuff, but there's still other substantial amounts. So it's in other parts of AIG where there are other issues that we're brewing too.
Mm-hmm. So if I could be maybe just a little bit more specific with my question, I apologize. If FP didn't have, without having to rely on the parent company, could FP itself have withstood the losses, say, through the, at least through the first or second quarter of 2008?
The way I think of us, FP, I know people see FP as a standalone, but I see us as an integral part.
Yeah, but answer her question. How much stuff did you have that you could have sold to meet the liquidity?
Was it a liquidity question or?
No, it's actually.
But losses. How much losses could you have sustained?
Well, right? Losses is a, you know, we had cash flow, so you could have sustained a large amount of loss, right? It's a question about how does a company operate, right? Mm-hmm. Companies operate on cash flow, right? Unrealized losses are not necessarily cash flow, right? So you can sustain a meaningful amount of unrealized losses as long as you can maintain your cash flow during that period. So the number can be fairly significant, right? It doesn't, unrealized losses don't put you into a negative cash flow position. It's one of the points, for me at least, about why forward the money, why spend the cash flow the way they did, why not hang on to it and preserve your cash flow.
Mm-hmm. When
on
that point though, when not to jump ahead too much, but I believe in terms of calculating the company's unrealized losses, at some point in 2007 you guys developed this binomial expansion technique model to estimate the unrealized valuation loss, right?
Yes.
Okay. Wasn't that model also used to estimate what the appropriate margin call should be to various counterparties?
Yes.
Right. The only point I'm making is that, yes, while unrealized valuation losses don't necessarily impact cash flow, they certainly can in a circumstance like this when they pretty, you know, the inputs are the same or substantially the same. Do you disagree with that?
I'm not sure I understand your question. Are you
if he understands our question.
Do you understand his question?
Well, now that he doesn't understand.
Good coaching there, Jim.
I wasn't coaching, I swear to God. I really didn't understand your question.
My only point
just want to make sure.
From what I've seen in the documents, you guys in September-October timeframe start developing this binomial expansion technique model, and that's what you use for the 352 unrealized loss estimate in September, and then the $11.2 billion estimate in accrued loss in for the fourth quarter of 07 that gets announced at the end of February 08. It's my understanding at the same time that when you guys are having disputes with the Goldmans of the world on what kind of money is owed, that you're using the same model to say, here's what we think the margin call should be. And so my only point is that while it is true that the act of recording an unrealized valuation loss isn't a cash flow event, because the same model is being used to determine the cash flow event, that is how much collateral needs to be posted. In this case, it may be pretty similar.
I see. Okay, but I want to be sure that we're clear. You're making a point, you're not asking a question, and so maybe
the question is, do you agree?
Well, can I suggest that asking the question another way? Again, and this is just terminology issue. The collateral calls, right, to the extent that you...
Hold on one second, then I'll let you speak. If you understood that question, do you agree, or tell me whether or not you don't understand my question.
I think I understand your question. I think it's more complicated than the way you're projecting it.
Okay.
And especially in terms of what's deemed the proper accounting valuation for these transactions, mm-hmm. versus what counterparts may have had as their mark to markets and, frankly, collateral calls. And I'm slightly complicated is that I, at least through my experience, I don't think in the more substantive collateral calls we ever agreed with the initial numbers that people were presenting to us. But there's a lot of complications in your question, especially on accounting valuation, mm-hmm. right? And I don't know if we want to go talk about all those things, but it could spiral into a long discussion. But I don't.
No, it's fine. That's fine.
Okay.
Did you want to add something?
I'm frankly just completely lost by this conversation, only because you're talking about unrealized losses and you're linking them to collateral calls, and you're doing that because of
the methodology
of the model. And I hope that this was clear in the SEC submission, because we really tried hard to distill this in a way that took reams of documents and distilled it. But the one version of the model, the JPM, did not predict what could have come back from collateral calls. The unadjusted version of the CDO manager model before the negative basis adjustment was a rough proxy, and based on that proxy, their analysis was that, and this is before the negative basis adjustment, right? Their analysis was that Goldman owed back almost $2 billion worth of collateral. So that's what confused me about your question. If your question is the collateral calls were theoretically linked to unrealized losses, there's a tether there, and isn't that a cash flow event? That's what I thought you were getting at, and that's what I was going to say. You got to look at the Lieberbull reports. They had significant assets that they were in the process of selling to meet all the margin calls, and while he was there, they did. So those collateral postings were assets on the books. They weren't losses. They were getting a LIBOR rate of interest, right? And he was managing liquidity sufficient to meet all those margin calls while he was there. So that's why there's a disconnect, at least in my mind, between the collateral call postings and the unrealized losses.
Thank you. So let's go back to where we were time frame-wise, which I think was getting towards the end of 05 when the book had gotten up to 54 bill and you guys had decided to stop writing CDS on subprime CDOs. So explain to me why the company decided to stop writing CDS on subprime CDOs.
The analysis was that we were seeing the very beginnings of slippage in underwriting standards, right? I think you know what I mean when I say that, right?
Mm-hmm.
That the guys were beginning to see, and I think where they were seeing it was in this filtering process that they were doing in the underwritings, is that somebody mentioned, more loans with no docs, more loans with I don't know, people trying to put more seconds in, I guess, right? There are all these terms that we're beginning that I heard about, things like sneaky seconds, people would call them, right? And so I think they were saying that, gee, I think what the guys were looking at, which was part of the culture in FE, is look, there's this, or the CDO market, the multi-sector CDO market, this whole business is growing, and it's growing really big. It's getting a crowded place. As things get more crowded, standards slip. If that begins to happen, let's not chase the ultimate risk. And basically, Andrew Foster took the lead with on this point and said, look, I think we need to begin to unwind the business, to wind down what we're doing in this business and move on to something else. Does that answer?
Yes. Okay. Yes. So was there any discussion about actually reducing the size of the book that existed at that point in addition to stopping writing the business?
When we were talking about this, there's the obvious question of what about what we've done so far, right? We have a book of this business. And the analysis was that we were probably ahead of the curve on this, and that the business that we had done to date was okay. And I think part of the analysis was that, home price appreciation was still, think about it, this is late 05, early 06, still going up, right? And so home price appreciation actually has a good part to do with what's going on. And the guys looked at this and they said, look, we think we're okay in these transactions. These are what we've done, the underwriting that we've done, and the rigor there is still good. And so we didn't think we needed to unwind any of those positions.
Mm-hmm. Was there any talk about hedging the book?
Again, the analysis, it's the same analysis, right, is do you shed the book, right, or do you hedge the book? And I think the view was, or as best as I remember now, that as I remember it now, the view was that no, there is no need to hedge the book up at this time. Also, because of the remoteness of the risk, right? And I'm sure you're familiar. I know you're familiar with you look at the subordination that we have, right, in the mezzanine business, right? That we in the business, the $14 billion that had the mezzanine type collateral in it, so you could think of that as the worst of the collateral pools, right? The subordination levels are somewhere around 37% on average in those, and with still substantive AAAs below them, right? So you sort of take comfort that you've done your analysis correctly, right? The supports are there, and in the high grade, I don't remember quite, but there was still a substantive amount of support there. And again, it's the same analysis, and I think the team thought that trying to find what kind of hedge you could do for that remote kind of risk was that this, that we basically had our hedge in our subordination.
Mm-hmm. And the fact that they were earlier vintages.
Right. Vintage was important, right?
Okay. Now, was there anyone at the company that was saying, either I disagree, I think we should reduce the level of the book, or hedge the book otherwise?
I don't remember anybody saying that.
Did the company actually put on any hedges at any point on that book?
Not that I remember.
Okay. Do you know if the company ever asked for quotes? Do you know if that's something to just lay off the risk? Hey, Goldman, hey, UBS, hey, whoever, what do you charge for a $1 billion CDS?
I don't remember.
How involved were you in the decision to exit the subprime multi-sector business, and then the decision that came after about whether or not to hedge or lay off the business?
Mr. Foster came to me in the summer, in probably the late summer, early September, and said that he had his view was that the underwriting, there may be a problem. There may be that underwriting standards, I shouldn't really count you as a problem. He said, look, it may be that, as I proposed for. This market is beginning to deteriorate. Underwriting may be beginning to deteriorate. I said, well, I asked him what he wanted to do about it. He said, well, I think I need to do some more research. And Andrew and a team of people went to New York and met with a variety of bankers and mortgage originators and a whole bunch of people to do this analysis. They then came back and they reported to me what their findings were. And Andrew was fairly firm in his view that we should, that, look, this is going to begin to get worse. The temptations are going to increase, basically. We should step back now. And I concurred with that decision. There was a meeting, a group of people, you know, me, Andy, Alan, Gary Gorton, John Capetta may have been there. You know, and as any of these things, there's always a range of views, right? I think Alan thought the business was still pretty robust. Gary thought that our underwritings were the way we were doing it. We could still do it because we have a substantive approach, but he also understood the argument. Andy was pretty firm that he thought we should leave, and so I began to wind down the business. And so we talked about it, and then we decided to wind it down. I was, you know, in these same sessions was when we had the discussion about, well, do we have to do anything about what we have now? And I left it with Andy and the guys to go through the analysis of what do they think. And, you know, the general consensus was no, you know, at that meeting, that everything's pretty good right now. But Andy and, you know, I don't quite know what analysis he did at this time, but he came back and said, no, we're pretty comfortable with where we are in the book. So hopefully that answers your question.
Ultimately, was your approval required on yes, we're going to stop, and no, we're not going to hedge?
I think Andrew could have stopped without my approval, and Andrew could have hedged without my approval if he wanted to, right? I think Andrew knew that stopping, people would have said, well, you know, that there would have been others who argued. And so I think what he wanted to do is make sure I concurred with his decision. But he clearly could have said no at any time he wanted to, and he knew that.
Okay. So did you have any discussions that we've been talking about? You've been talking about discussions within folks at FP about the decision to stop writing on subprime and concerns about slipping underwriting standards. Any discussions with the folks at the parent company in this time frame about those concerns and the decision to stop writing on subprime?
I think one of the people that Andrew talked to when he was in New York about underwriting standards, I think, was Kevin McGinn. At who I think you know
is
Chief Credit Officer at AIG, right? I think he was one of the guys. But I also know that the FP credit officers informed Kevin that we were exiting or, you know, we were stopping writing multi-sector CDOs on the in the creditor of super senior multi-sector.
And I get that, and they would have seen it in the reports.
Well, no, you see, you just don't see it, right? That, mm-hmm. Yeah, right. I mean, a lot of times people don't
see what's not there.
Right. Thank you.
Did you report it to anyone?
Well, I had a discussion with Bill about it, right? Bill Dooley called me and said he had heard from Kevin that we had, Bill Dooley was my direct report.
Right.
And he had said that he had heard from Kevin that we had, that we were going to stop this, and I, you know, explained to him what almost exactly what I'm talking to you guys about here, and went through that the analysis with him and stuff, and you know, one of the Bill said, well, you know, which is what managers say, how are you going to replace the revenue? Right? And I said, look, that's what we get paid for. You know, we got to figure it out. I don't know yet. You know, that's the hard part of the business, but this is what we should do. And Bill concurred with the decision we were making. You know, after I talked to him about it. Or, you know, he concurred in that conversation, I should say.
So, and thank you for that. I was asking something a little different. Before the decisions made to stop, did you have any discussions with anyone at AIG Inc. where, you know, they were expressing concerns about the subprime market and slipping underwriting standards?
No, not that I remember. I mean, I don't think so. I think this was an event being... Because, you know, I don't remember anybody having a conversation with me.
Okay. I suspect you've seen the invitation letter we sent you, and I don't know if you're going to know about this since it's not within FP, but we've seen in the documents that, you know,
the
after you guys...
which I volunteered to come.
A verification of your voluntary.
Well, no,
I guess we could have said, please thank you for coming.
I was thinking,
you are hereby invited.
Right. I was thinking, gee, I volunteered that, you know, and stuff. And then I got the letter that said I'm invited. And I said, I volunteered. That's okay.
No, but they did put volunteer.
The letter,
no,
there says it. The letter actually technically thanks you for volunteering.
Yes, exactly. It's only the title of the letter that says invitation.
Our thank you letter.
I didn't mean to digress.
But
there were questions in there, but I wanted you to just...
Right, so now let me try to remember what they were. So, and...
other people.
Right, other people. So what we have seen in the documents is that at the time that FP decides to stop writing CDS on subprime, there are other parts of the organization, for example, the securities lending business, that can actually is increasing its exposure to subprime by investing in larger and larger amounts in RMBS. I guess my first question is, were you aware of that?
You know, AIG is such a big place.
Yes.
No. Okay. Sorry.
Yeah. And that's... Thank you. I make your life easier this way.
Thank you.
What kind of conversation, and generally then, did you have with folks like Bob Lewis, who was the chief risk officer and the head of enterprise risk management? Did this subject ever come up? We're going to stop writing subprime, and did he ever say, well, that's all fine and good, securities lending still up in exposure?
No, I don't. Bob and I chatted, talked periodically, right, about a whole bunch of things, but I don't remember this kind of a conversation.
Okay. You mentioned that your direct report was Bill Dooley, who I think was head of the financial services division, right?
Yes.
Okay. Did you report to Lewis too? I mean, how did that work generally in terms of dotted line reporting relationships or otherwise?
You have to put a time period on that because I just want to be clear. Yeah,
that's fair. My understanding is when he becomes chief risk officer, which I understand is July of 2004.
Okay.
So from that time period forward.
So enterprise risk manager, right? Yeah.
Right. And head of that group, right?
Right. Think about these dotted lines and I don't quite understand them sometimes. So Bill was my operational boss, mm-hmm. Bill Dooley, right? And I reported to him and he was the head of financial services. But my relationship with Bob was that Bob was the enterprise risk manager for the global company. And what that meant is that Bob had a direct input in our world, so in FP, right? In market risk, in credit risk, and in operational risk. If he asked me about those things and stuff, I had an obligation to work with him, report to him, talk to him about them, and do those things. But for the business decisions we were making in the business itself, you know, sort of, are we going to hire people? Are we going to, you know, mm-hmm. That was Bill, right? And I didn't engage Bob in those things. But if we were going to go into a new business, and it had a credit risk component to it, or a market risk component to it, or, you know, or even for our own operational controls, I needed to talk to Bob or one of Bob's designees about things.
So then did you talk to Bob Lewis when you guys have the concerns about subprime that ultimately leads to the decision to stop writing CDS on subprime CDOs?
No, because my team talked to Kevin, who I knew was talking to Bob, and Kevin and Bob had a very, you know, he was one of Bob's designees on this. And so it was, and I knew that Kevin was talking to Bill, right, because Bill had called me, so I was pretty convinced that, or, you know, that Kevin was talking to Bob.
All I'm getting at is it seems like a fairly significant decision, and I'm just wondering what role, if you had any conversations with the chief risk officer about it.
Well, Well, and the team talked to the chief credit officer about it.
Yeah, but his question is different. And this is a question I think that you already said that you don't remember. Do you remember whether you or any member of your team actually talked directly to Bob Lewis?
I don't remember.
Okay.
Right.
And do you remember if you ever talked to Bob Lewis about whether or not other parts of the organization were continuing to take on, to continue to increase their exposure to subprime?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. All right. Now, we know, I don't want to just jump right from early 06 to July of 07 when the collateral call comes in, unless we can do it this way. Is there anything noteworthy that comes to mind in terms of issues with the with the multi-sector book between the decision to stop writing CDS on subprime and the memorable day in July when the Goldman call comes in?
Can I ask you this? Since we're now at our two-hour mark, can we
really?
Take a quick
sure.
coffee break?
Of course.
Right,
yeah.
And that's a big question, so
sure.
I might be able to help.
That's fine.
Caribou downstairs.
Is that the